This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 32nd in our series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Jeremiah Grossman. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Jeremiah Grossman is founder and CTO of White Hat Security. Jeremiah is well known for his work in web application security in particular. He's also a fellow member of the Security Evangelist Circle, which means that we cross paths a few times a year. Just a few. Jeremiah co-authored the book XSS Exploits, which means cross-site scripting, of course, with five others, including RSnake. And he was born and raised in Maui. And Jeremiah lives with his family in Silicon Valley now and starred in the documentary The New Face of Cybercrime.
No, actually, that was Robert Hanson, not me.
Oh, that was Hanson? I thought you were in that.
Nope.
I know RSnake was in there, but I thought you were too.
He was the guy that was hacking AOL. I've moved beyond that.
I see. You haven't. You don't do that anymore.
Not anymore.
Excellent. All right, so let's start way down in the weeds, I was thinking. We would start with clickjacking. So tell us about how the attack works and kind of a little bit about the technical side. And then, more importantly, tell us the backstory behind the Adobe dust-up thing.
Sure. I think the latter part is a more interesting one. But clickjacking, it's when an attacker can force a user to click on something that they didn't intend. So if you imagine a web page and all the different web pages out there that have important buttons on them, some that'll send email, some that'll add friends, some that'll wire transfer money. If you're on an attacker-controlled web page, they will iframe in a button from another website and hover that iframe just under your mouse transparently so you can't see it. So when you think you're clicking on a link, you're clicking on a button that the bad guy wanted you to click on. Mm-hmm. And one of the implementations that, examples that we wanted to show was how you can hijack a user's video camera and microphone using Flash. And so we use clickjacking to, on the permissions button when Flash asks to access your microphone and a web page can now see and hear you, which got pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. And I guess for your particular hack that you ended up not talking about, you were using the Adobe plugin, some sort of exploit in Adobe?
We feel Robert Hanson and myself felt that clickjacking was more of a browser issue and not so much an Adobe issue. And, we're just using Flash as an example. There was no real exploit to it that we knew of at the time. So when we wanted to do a presentation on the subject, and this has been a long-known issue by the browser vendors, but we felt that it wasn't given its due attention. Mm-hmm. And so when we tried to do a presentation at OWASP, Adobe caught wind that we're using their product, and apparently without us really realizing it, we had found a zero day in the Adobe Flash Player because you're not supposed to be able to make the permissions dialog transparent.
Right,
we just never realized it. So that's when, we had to pull the talk because Adobe asked for more time, which is fine because they weren't given a whole lot of time, but it caused a little bit of a media circus there, and it's not what we wanted, but it's what happened anyway.
Right, and the irony is, I guess, that you didn't really need that zero day to have the real attack. That was just kind of one of your vectors.
Correct. So we did the best we could with what we had, so we told people what we could about clickjacking, and then later when Adobe had the issue, well, Adobe was in the process of patching it with Flash Player 10, but somebody else who figured out the issue preempted them and leaked the disclosure that you can do it with a Flash Player, so we came out with the rest of it.
Right. So in that case, just to be clear, who's at fault, the browser or the plugin?
I think it's the browser vendor. The way Adobe looked at it is, just independently of whatever the browser vendors do or don't do, they wanted to do everything that they could to protect their users. So that was pretty cool of them, because we didn't expect them to do anything about it, but they wanted to anyway.
They have some decent security guys over there. Like half the old at-stake staff is there now.
They got some really good guys, some sharp ideas, and generally want to do the right thing, and just from our experience working with them.
So another critical and underappreciated web problem is cross-site request forgery. And I think you've called that the sleeping giant of web bugs. I love that quote. So how does that attack work?
Cross-site request forgery is when an attacker can force a user to make a request that they didn't intend to make. So, you know, to use the, you know, the bank analogies again, if you wanted to wire transfer money from one account to another, that's one particular web request. If you wanted to add a friend to your social networking profile, that's another request. Now, if those requests are predictable, using, you know, an image tag would be enough. So if you were to visit my blog, I can force your browser to make a request to your web bank and transfer your money out to me or add me as a friend or dig a story up or any request on the web. Mm-hmm. And if proper protections aren't made, I can make the real user make a valid request, just not one that they intended. And that's the difficult part on the website side, is everything looks legit because everything is legit except the intent.
So you know, there's a lot of confusion with cross-site scripting, between cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery. And in the Felton paper that you guys should check out, the listeners should check out, CSRF Exploitation and Prevention, they had a sentence that I really liked that said, cross-site scripting always implies cross-site request forgery. But if you're not susceptible to cross-site scripting, that does not mean you're not susceptible to cross-site request forgery. How's that for logically packed?
Yeah, it's a tough one to delineate. What helped me out is that there's trust relationships in both directions.
Yeah.
When you're looking at cross-site request forgery, it exploits the trust that a website has for a user.
Right.
And in cross-site scripting, it exploits the trust that a user has for a website. So when you get them both working in combination, that's when you get things like webworms and things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in the end, this sounds kind of like a classic interposition attack, really. And in this case, the attacker is wedged between the user and the user's browser, which many
Correct.
People think of the same thing, right? But they're not the same thing. And so that means, if you just think of it as interposition attack, that there are lots and lots of non-web kind of counterparts out there in the world.
Browser security and how it interplays is a really complex subject, and it's all right now. Web security is and browser security is basically broken.
Right.
It's really difficult for a user, if not impossible, for a user to protect themselves online now, even if they've patched everything and securely configured everything.
So, can discovery of cross-site request forgery be automated from a black box security testing perspective?
Sometimes, in very particular cases. I'll give you an example. Why we're making progress on it. If you have a form on the page that has three input type equals password fields, you can infer that it is a change password page.
Mm-hmm.
If a page has just one input type equals password, that's probably a login form.
Mm-hmm.
If there's two input type fields, that is likely a change password page that doesn't require or doesn't request the old password. So you can find cross-site request forgery there with a high degree of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one example. And we've been finding other places, other ways to get characteristics from a site to see, you know, to find cross-site request forgery. But by and large, how far the needle has moved, we're probably in the 5 to 10% range.
Yeah, I think there's some countermeasures also that the Felton paper mentions that are worth looking into. So at Fidelity Software Security Day, where you and I both were, you said in your talk that about 50% of web problems, or at least the ones that you had on some slide, couldn't be automated. And so the question is, why? What's the nature of those problems that can't be sort of automatically tested?
Sure. I was talking about classes of attacks, like overall. If you look at the, you know, whether it's the OS Top 10, the WAS 24, about half of the classes you can automate with, you know, some degree of accuracy, like cross-site scripting, SQL injection, and a bunch of the other ones that we generally term as technical vulnerabilities. But on the other half is you get these things that we loosely define as business logic flaws,
mm-hmm.
where it requires a knowledge of context. So if I have a number and a URL, your bank account information, and I rotate it down from 100 to 99, I might see your account data. That could be good or bad. To an automated tool, it's just data.
Right.
Sometimes I might be allowed to see your data, sometimes not. But how's the tool ever going to know?
So you need to know more about what's going on in the app.
Yeah, it's more about the user, what they're supposed to be able to do or not supposed to be able to do. And we're inching the needle along, but by and large, those business logic flaws are, you know, a lot of scanners have a really tough time, and even humans have a tough time finding it in a lot of cases.
So I'm interested in kind of the difference between a business logic flaw and an architectural flaw from a technical perspective. Are you sort of just treating those as the same thing?
An example, so we can talk on the same language.
Right.
So what would you consider an architectural flaw, just so I see where you're going?
Well, kind of this notion of, say, a replay attack or maybe some way of overriding a method that isn't related to a particular bug but is kind of higher level in nature. But
gotcha.
But it might be higher level from a technical perspective, but not necessarily related to the business application itself. See what I mean?
Right. So I think most of the time, if something can be automated, it tends to go into the technical vulnerability bucket. If it really can't, it tends to go in the business logic one. And these are just loose terms. We shouldn't take them like all that seriously. But for instance, there are business logic flaws or architectural flaws that are, you know, by design, this is how the system is supposed to work.
Right, right, right.
It just, you know.
And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, so you might consider that an architectural flaw or, you know, usually insufficient authentication or authorization. Those are pretty defined as, you know, business logic flaws. You know, it didn't have a right check to see if a user was authorized or authenticated to do a particular task. The amount of terminology in this industry is staggering.
So you may not know this, but I got my start back in the browser wars too, back when there was this company called Netscape.
You did? I had no idea, really.
Yeah. I wrote this book called Java Security with Ed Felton, and it was all about bugs in Java, really, but that had to do with applets, and, you know, it was 10 years ago. So these days, as you know, I'm concerned about an overemphasis on web security, and so the question is, am I getting old?
all the same problems exist. They're just exacerbated. I just looked at Netcraft today, and there's 182 million websites out there. You and I can both guess how many of those were designed with security in mind.
I guess in the early days, it was a little bit easier to talk about the browser and the browser being the problem. And nobody was confused about that. These days,
right,
there's so many active content systems that it's hard to tell whether it's a browser problem or a JavaScript plugin problem or an application written in, you know, Ajax or whatever. And that leads to a little bit more confusion about who's at fault, I think.
Precisely. I mean, I used to read in books, right, we're supposed to design our, you know, you don't trust the client for security, right? You know, you have that standard mantra.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we can do that anymore.
I'm with you on that. I mean, you know, to some extent, the early browsers, say after Lynx towards the Mosaic browser, were really, really simple. So they were much more like a VT100
right,
than they are like these kind of almost platform operating system things today.
I don't think almost. I think it is. I mean,
mm-hmm. Well, that was what worried Microsoft in the early days in the mid-90s when they didn't even have a browser in 1996. They were worried that the browser was going to take the place of the operating system. And to some extent, they were just a little bit ahead of their time in that worry.
Well, I think it's still going that way. I mean, I still use my desktop, my OS, but I think, you know, for most people out there that are connected, most of the time is spent in the browser and not on their computer, so to speak.
Right. So in 1996, we knew this browser problem existed. In fact, we even knew that authentication, like we were talking about before with the cross-site request forgery issue, was a huge problem. There was this paper that Felton and his guys at Princeton wrote called Web Spoofing. Have you ever seen that paper?
I may have. I don't recall.
Right. So it was just interposing between, say, a user or the user's browser in this case and the rest of the web. And you would just build a proxy server and take control of somebody's view of the web so they couldn't really trust anything at all. And hilariously, that'll still kind of work.
Yeah. So that's you know, I remember, you know, reading when I was, you know, got my start around 98, 99, I was reading all these papers, and, you know, I come back around 4, 5, 6 years later, they're all still there, hence, you know, when I go, you know, this is a really bad problem, and it's kind of like a sleeping giant out there, was what I was just kind of, you know.
Yeah, right. Because it's not really totally new, but it's really important.
Yeah, so I kind of raised my hand going like this. Had anybody thought about this? <Yeah.
laughs> We had an interesting conundrum in academia once on a program committee I was on for one of these academic conferences. I think it was Oakland, but it might have been ISOC NDSS. In any case, somebody had resubmitted this idea of web spoofing, and it was a paper about the same thing 5 years later just to show that it still works.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a big argument about whether that should be accepted in an academic conference or not. I can't remember how it was resolved, but I do remember the fight.
Oh, yeah, that same issue. It was discovered, like, you know, 5, 6, 7 different times and given a different name each time.
Exactly. So in the end of all this, which browser do you use?
I actually use two browsers. I'm primarily a Mac user, so I use Firefox primarily. Mm-hmm. But I don't do anything important on it. When I want to do something important, I actually fire up some old ancient operating system, go to the site. I mean, old ancient browser, and I go to the site that I want to do business with, do business, and log out, you know, never use that browser.
Throw away browsers.
Pretty much.
Are you paranoid enough to invoke a fresh virtual machine when you do that or not?
Not yet, but I'm getting there. I know many others who are.
Yeah, there are some people that do that.
And what I do know is I've seen a lot of security people actually use that approach for their children at home.
Right. That's a good idea. So we discussed this notion of how cross-site request forgery is really kind of like an interposition attack. And I wanted to ask you if you believe that many web application attacks have kind of wider counterparts in software security.
Such as?
Well, just a way of saying, oh, yes, this is a particular version of this way of thinking about an attack when it comes to a browser or a web app. But if you look kind of up the food chain to more software, they're susceptible to the very same attacks.
It could be. I just my expertise, you know, is in web software. I look at a website and go, what can I make this do other than what was intended? And mm-hmm. I'm sure, well, web security came way later. I'm sure the same classes of attack that we're using on the web are applicable, you know, since the beginning of software. I can only put it in a web security context normally.
I think the web security context is really important. And I also think that perhaps you guys are finding some interesting new twists that haven't been talked about or looked for in the wider software thing. So if we did this mapping, there might be a way to learn from each other both directions, which is
I think some of the, you know, the more interesting stuff to us is we're finding lots of you know, we're doubling, tripling coding our attacks going in and doing different styles of, you know, encoding and transcoding, whatever you want to call it.
There you go. Yeah.
And they're working. They're working in a very, very small percentage of cases. Each test is like an edge case.
Right.
But we're actually finding a lot of edges now out there.
Oh, that's interesting. So some of the classic kind of software exploitation techniques as applied to web attacks.
So let's say we take a SQL injection string and we triple encode it with a bunch of different wacky stuff. It'll only work on, you know, 1% of sites, if not less, 0.01% of sites, you know. But it does work. And then we stack, you know, 100 on those, and they start working a lot, you know, all over the place. So mm-hmm. that's the kind of statistics we're gathering these days.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And I think as we were sort of talking about before, you know, I want to get to this notion of architecture a little bit more. So you think that the web browser now is kind of like an operating system. I also see on the other side of the world kind of these thicker and thicker clients getting built, some of which use web protocols and many of which don't, but they're certainly thicker clients than they used to be. And so I think what's happening is these two worlds are kind of colliding or coming together because of the kinds of distributed system applications that people are building.
Well, what happens is that developers want to do things in a web page that the browser doesn't readily support. So if the browser vendors aren't going to put it in, the plugin vendors will.
Right. So the browser becomes thicker and it supports all that stuff. But I'm also thinking about, say, thick clients of the sort that, say, the World of Warcraft guys use.
Oh, sure.
You know, they have a 9 gigabyte client. It isn't little. And there's lots of stuff in there. I think, you know, in terms of kind of software security issues and exploits, it seems like these worlds are getting more and more, they're coming together more and more.
They could be. I think that they deal with a slightly different set of problems. You know, I guess, you know, when I look at, when I spawn cross-site request forgery using HTML, mm-hmm. inside the in-game, I don't know if I can force another user to make a request that they didn't intend to make in that type of environment.
Right. So that's kind of a helpful design feature these days.
But they do suffer from massive architecture issues, with like race conditions. They call it duping in the game, where you take an item and you run across server lines and you get a duplicate item if you know what you're doing.
Yep.
So they do have other very interesting. They have actually the most interesting logic flaws I've ever seen.
And I think some of these timing issues will probably be an interesting area to explore on the web too. I know that Dan Bonet was thinking about that recently.
Could be. There's lots of different crazy attacks that happen in massive multiplayer games that probably could happen in a web context.
So I guess you're not paranoid enough to use Lynx.
not yet.
but you're coming around to that.
Well, security guys, we always have to be careful not to confuse what's possible with what's probable.
but it seems like a lot of people are saying, "Good Lord, can't we just rebuild a browser that isn't a complete disaster?" Matt Bishop actually talked about that in the last episode of Silver Bullet.
I actually just wrote a blog post on that, and my belief is that probably not. If a browser is hoping to get used, it probably can't and won't be secure against the latest attacks, because the latest attack, you know, if we had these good defenses in there, no one would use the browser because the web would feasibly break. So what happens is, in browser security, they make it as good as they can while, you know, trying to maintain their market share, and then other security plugin vendors will say, okay, you know, here's how to protect against this style of attack, and users, you know, adopt it. And when the strategy is well vetted, then they build it into the main core of the browser. We've seen this in phishing most recently, all the green toolbar and things like that. So that's there, and we see it again in IE8 when in some of the the NoScript features are now showing up in, you know, the IE8 toolbar. So that's usually how it happens. So unfortunately, the browser will never be as secure as it needs to be.
Right. So one other issue I wanted to bring up, because your company specializes in this and does a great job with it, and that is this notion of penetration testing, or automated penetration testing, automated security testing of a web app.
Sure.
And I'm wondering how philosophically we can move penetration testing past this badnessometer mode that it's in now, so that we can take the results and cycle them back into building better stuff.
So here's how I look at it. From White Hat's point of view, my job is to measure the security of the website as it looks from an external attacker.
Exactly.
And I'm always, and there's no way I'm going to get away from measuring badness in that way.
No, and I think it's a good thing. I just want to, you know, make that clear. That's a good thing to do.
Yeah. So from that point forward, you go, okay, what was the causality? When I find something that's bad, what led to that fact?
Right.
And then start pushing that earlier and earlier and early into the SDL, or, you know, wherever we choose to. Maybe it was a design issue. Maybe it was implementation.
Mm-hmm.
And we can start to learn some of those things. But that's just how I look at the world. I don't want it to be a forever, you know, find and fix kind of thing. But that's actually not, I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon.
I don't either. I think actually there's a pretty big distinction between the East Coast and the West Coast when it comes to that stuff. And the East Coast has been piling up bugs for maybe slightly longer because of the financial services industry.
Sure.
And the bug pile got really damn big. And, you know,
yeah,
you'd hire some guys to find some more bugs, and then you'd throw them on the pile, and you go, geez, that's going to collapse and kill us all. And so they started thinking about making some of the results from these penetration tests more actionable, easier to fix, and easier to diagnose in terms of code and what needed to be done and what kind of training needs to happen. On the other hand, I don't see that same movement yet on the West Coast. I think it's about maybe 18 months behind.
So if you want to put an East Coast, West Coast context, that then we have, at least on the West Coast, we have two very large problems. Mm-hmm. One is we already had, like I said, we have 180 million sites that are already vulnerable.
What exactly.
Do we do about that? And so, you know,
I think what we do is make more.
Yeah, that's what we do. So we have this rapid application cycle out there, which causes many problems. So one is, even if we knew where the problems were, they're not going to get fixed anytime soon. That's why I've been doing the whole VA WAF integration thing.
Right.
But the other one that's particularly concerning to me is every year we have different attack classes and new variants on a theme, it's been happening from 2005, 6, 7, 8, and the problem is even if we're developed our code securely from, you know, quote unquote from the beginning, the state of the art, how do we rev our code and update it against the new latest and greatest attacks on all the old sites?
I hear you. And there's even some old attacks that have against code that's been running since like the 70s.
Yeah,
I mean,
we
have some customers who say, can you help us fix our COBOL application? And the answer can't be no.
So, you know, we have this whole software serviceability thing out there, and that's going to be a really tough problem.
Yeah,
you know?
Very interesting. I agree.
When somebody comes up with a new web security attack acronym, are we going to have to go update 180 million websites out there?
I hope not.
that's a really big deal.
So I saw your wall of fame on your blog. And I have one of those too that I've been building since 1996, but I call mine the wall of shame. And last year it got so heavy that the wire broke and it fell down, and I had to figure out how to smoosh it all back together. And of all the talks that you gave that resulted in all those bajillions of name badges at various conferences this year, which one was the most fun and why?
Oh man, that's tough. I get something out of each different conference I go to. Blackhat is definitely a cool conference. You know, there's a lot of great speakers, a lot of great people there. But also, I've been liking Hack in the Box. You know, it's in different countries. I just got back from Malaysia. That was definitely a cool conference. Highly technical.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different set of people. You know, there's very few Americans there, so I get to interface with a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also been to, you know, CSI and different places like that. You get to see more government and businessy type people there. So it just depends on what you're into. I get something out of it.
I think I asked you this question too close to the election because I wanted you to pick one, not four.
Oh God, there's no way. There's no way. I think I've been going to Blackhat USA every year for like 4 or 5 years.
Uh-huh.
So if that's the one I don't miss, so I'll pick that one.
That's cool. That sounds good. But it sounds like you have fun when you do these things anyway.
Oh yeah, it's really easy. I guess I know something of value, and you know, I put my slides together and, you know, create an interesting concept, and people come and listen. They give good feedback, and so it's a good job.
Cool. Well, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Anytime, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The November-December 2008 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine is a special issue about process control and SCADA security, edited by Charles Palmer from IBM and Ron Trelew. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.